Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we're full up with our guests and co-hosts and everybody else joining us tonight. So I'm looking forward to a fun-filled show with a lot of interaction and questions and great information for you. Of course, nothing happens. No information changes hands at all without our great co-host, Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Oh, I do this show every week just to hear you say nice things. I appreciate that, Jimmy. Well, things are pretty much the same around here in Colorado. Weather's nice. Afternoon thunderstorms. But I don't know. I haven't kept track of anything going on out there in hurricane land. So our Becky DuPadwin can fill us in on that.
Well, thankfully, hurricane land is quiet after we had the one last week. And I can't even make a quick landfall, produce some flooding, heavy rains kind of in the Delmarva area, gusty winds kind of up through Long Island, and that really wasn't too impactful, just a little bit of flooding. Since then, things have been pretty quiet. Tropics are quieted down for now. Still have some severe weather. Chicago may get some severe storms tomorrow. That would be Wednesday, July 15th. Otherwise, it's really, really hot, as you would expect for the middle of July. Very hot in a lot of the south. Hot and humid, temps in the hundreds, well above 100. Kind of just summer. Storms in Colorado for
kind of summer, huh? I needed a meteorologist to tell us that.
That's why you bring me on for the expert analysis, huh?
Yeah, beautiful. We appreciate that. Well, it's nice to have you around when something unique is going on, but it's summer, so there we go. We have Kevin with us. He's our wilderness safety guy, one of our wilderness experts, and also he was a rescue diver. So that's kind of where we're going here tonight. We're going to talk about something we haven't talked about much, and that's hyperbaric medicine. Now, I have to tell you where we started with this. You all know Chris Prutzman. He's been around here doing a number of podcasts. Well, if you remember or not, he was responsible for me learning to become a scuba diver. But he didn't do that alone. He was with his friend, Paul Watts, who I haven't talked to since, I don't know, Paul, the early 90s. And Chris lately hooked me up. Yeah. Chris lately hooked me up with him, and it was very nice. And it turns out he's in hyperbaric tech in where, Nevada, Paul?
Yeah, Las Vegas.
There you go. I should have recognized the area code. So we're going to talk to him about that. And we got Dr. Joe here as well, who certainly can give us some perspective on the clinical side. So there we go. So, Paul, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Oh, well, I'm Paul Watts. I'm the hyperbaric safety director at Sunrise Hospital in Las Vegas. Been here for almost 20 years, and we see all kinds of injuries. I did some time working with on the research side of hyperbaric, so I've seen the off-label, the non-clinical or non-hospital-based stuff, as well as primarily all of the hospital indications. That's basically about me.
Well, we got a lot of questions for you. But first, Joe, can you give us kind of in a nutshell what hyperbaric therapy does?
Well, sure, I'll be glad to. Hyperbarics is basically the use of oxygen generally under high pressures, two or three atmospheres most of the time. And the idea is that you sort of supersaturate the environment so that you get more oxygen carrying capacity into tissues that are ischemic, infected, or just not very well perfused in general. So it has lots of different uses, from wound care and that sort of stuff on a kind of chronic standpoint, to treatment of dive medicine and all the issues that come with scuba diving, deep water diving, etc.
Well, what surprised me was all of the different things they're using it for now. And I'm sure that's kind of how Paul got into it from being a diver. But I was kind of blown away by all the different things they're doing. And I'm going to ask about a couple of those later. But one of our community asked how many hyperbaric centers are there around the U.S. So I did a little research, and there are about 1,375 chambers, but only 130 accept patients on an emergency basis. And there's only two that are dedicated solely to divers. And from what I read, about 10% of them take divers. And I always thought that was kind of the main use for them, but it seems things have changed. And there's also, Paul, you can talk to this, but there's a lot of places that don't have staffing 24/7, because I guess it's quite expensive to do that. So I guess people call Dan, the Divers Alert Network, to find out where one may be available. Do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Sure. We picked it. Sunrise has been here since 1998. We picked up the Dan Divers side in 2014 when UMC, which had a 12-person multi-place chamber and a 3-person multi-place chamber, their contracts expired and they were forced to leave. So that left the entire southern half of the state without a emergent chamber system. So we picked that up in 2014. And so, yeah, you call Dan, and Dan would luckily, hopefully, call Dan. And we've had people in the past that didn't call Dan, and the outcome wasn't so good.
Well, you don't think about Vegas as being the water sports capital of the world, but I guess they got Lake Mead out there and stuff. But this kind of leads into the second question from the community. What's the difference between types of chambers and the treatments that could be administered, i.e., is there only certain chambers that are appropriate for divers?
No. Actually, I shouldn't say no. I have to qualify that. There's several types of hyperbarics. One is called mild hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which, yeah, it's of no use to a diver. The second one is monoplace. Monoplace are one person in a chamber at a time being treated, and that covers 80% of the current market in the world, basically. And then the 20% remaining are what we consider the old research facilities, which are the big multi-place chambers. Those are super expensive, super hard to operate. And so they're starting to fall out of favor. Most places are going with a monoplace because it's cheaper. A multi-place system, just for putting the place together, for let's say like the 12th person, you're talking almost $3 million, and then you're talking $40,000 a month in maintenance, just maintenance. And the monoplaces are $100,000 each, and the maintenance is taken care of by the technical staff. And every year they have the annual cost about $1,200. So the cost difference is one of the main reasons. The treatments are basically the same for divers. If you're familiar with the Navy dive manual, they've got separate protocols or separate treatment tables for the different chambers. The ones we use primarily in monoplace chambers is a treatment table 6. And if you're familiar with table 6, it allows you several extensions, both in depth and time, to achieve your aim. And in a multiplace, they use mixed gases, and they can take somebody down to 165 feet to achieve the same thing. We can achieve at 60 feet, so it's cheaper for us to do it. And that's one of the reasons that there's only a handful of places that offer it for the divers, because you have to keep a team of 8 people on call 24/7 with a multi-place chamber. And with a monoplace chamber, you only have to keep 2, the doctor and the technician.
Well, I have heard there are situations where you may need multi-chambers because in a case of burn injury and that kind of thing. And again, we'll get back to that. But Kevin just sent something in the sidebar that I remember you teaching me, Paul, that it isn't always when they first come out of the water that we know that there's a problem. Sometimes they return from a vacation and start having some strange symptoms, and people don't associate it with diving. Kevin, you want to expand on that?
Sure. So you'll have the somebody who goes on a diving vacation, and they may go to the Bahamas or Mexico or somewhere. And instead of waiting the required 24 hours before they get on a plane, they may wait 6 or 12 hours. And they get home, and a day or two later, they might start developing symptoms, and they don't immediately associate it with the scuba diving. Or as you said it before, which I love, scuba diving. So they don't associate that with a potential DCS or DCI injury. And it's not till later on they find out. And that's when it could have been treated a lot earlier, sooner, and they have a better outcome.
Exactly. Yeah, that's something a lot of people don't know, isn't it? As much as we learn about tables and all of that different thing, those kind of different things, people need to realize that 8 hours is there for a reason. Becky, you got a question.
Well, so for those of us not fully in the know, two questions. Is there a depth at which these impacts can happen? And then what are the symptoms that people would be experiencing after diving and then getting on a plane?
Paul, why don't you start with that one, and Kevin can tag on.
As you say, in indications, there are several, but usually the most, it depends on which type of DCS or DCI you've suffered. Luckily for us, all the ones we have been, it's always been a neuro issue. We've had our patients that, they got out of the water and went to take their wetsuit off, and they found out it was easy to put on, but now they can't get it off because their shoulders aren't working. We've had people that got out of the water trying to hold the conversation and couldn't talk. We've had people that got out of the water, went drinking. Back up. She got out of the water. She knew she was bit because she was a dive master. She just figured that she would walk it off. So she spent the rest of the day shopping, drinking, partying, and then got up the next morning, felt worse. Her right leg wasn't working. And then she got on an airplane.
Perfect scenario. I like how you made that a female, Paul. By the way, DCS is decompression sickness, and DCI is decompression illness. And Joe, you want to expand on those just a little bit on the symptomology and so forth?
Yeah, happy to. So the symptoms are basically related to gases that are compressed in the body when you're down deep. And then as you come up, those gases expand. And if they expand in tissues where you don't want them, like nerves and muscles and that kind of stuff, then that's what gives you the symptomatology. So one of the most common places for those bubbles, particularly nitrogen, to re-expand themselves are in the nervous system, and that leads to all sorts of weird neurological complaints, as you just heard in some of those cases that were presented. But it can lead to certainly cardiac difficulties, a lot of muscle aches and that sort of stuff when the nitrogen expands in the muscle tissue as well. So I think the most common complaint is related to the neurologic system. Those are obviously the most dangerous because those can be permanent if that's not treated.
Well, Paul's scenario is definitely interesting. And is it common for dive masters to think that they know they're bent, but they can just go have a drink and it'll be all better? I don't know. Kevin, any thoughts you want to add to that?
Yeah, dive masters should know better. That's all I'll say about that.
Well, Kevin, to go back to that one, because that was like the weirdest one we've had, because not only did she know she was bit, she confirmed she was bit because she called Dan while she was on vacation, and then she was diving with three other dive masters. So you've got four people there that know your bent, and you're going to carry on.
There's just no excuse for that. In my personal and professional opinion, I mean, I am also a dive master. I was formerly a DMT trained at Duke University and Dan, headquarters in North Carolina. There's no excuse for that. If you're a dive master and you call Dan and you get told you're bent, that should be an indication to stop diving and at least get oxygen to kind of knock it down and then seek treatment.
Yeah.
Maybe they were drinking too much. Who knows?
Well, they were. They didn't start till after. That's the weirdest part, because we were sitting here talking, because we're getting the intel before we put her in the chamber. We're like, oh, wait, so you knew you were bent, and everybody around you knew you were bent. Even Dan told you were bent. Oh, they said Dan was highly likely. I'm sorry. They said it was highly likely without a medical intervention or without reporting from a medical professional that she was bent, and they still carried on. And the only reason we actually got to treat her was when she got back to Las Vegas. Her boyfriend went to pick up at the airport because she couldn't get out of the seat in the airline. They had to send a wheelchair to get her out of the plane.
Yeah, that's kind of a clue. Good grief. I remember, this is a little bit offsides, but I remember a story I think you told us about nitrogen narcosis and how it kind of messes with your mind and it affects different people at different levels. And some gal was, you know, taking a class and going down the line with her dive partner, and suddenly the partner turns around and she's off somewhere, and he turns to look for her, and she's trying to trying to breathe a fish with her mask, basically buddy breathing a fish. So I don't know, Joe, you want to throw in on that one? I think it's kind of an interesting thing. Fortunately, I've never had it.
Well, I think it's part of that spectrum, right? The bizarre behavior, hallucinations, significant neurologic alterations of consciousness are part of the bends, and can creep up on you. And as we've already heard, can frequently occur sometime after you're actually out of the deep water and back at atmospheric level.
Well, I obviously just came to realize, Paul, that was not a hypothetical situation. That actually happened. Kevin makes a point. Being narked is like being drunk underwater. But it's a very different scenario than DCI or DCS.
And the difference with narc, though, when something startling happens, that kind of clears. It's like being drunk. But the difference with narcosis is when you get shallower or something earth-shattering happens, like you're narc, but then you see a great white shark. It kind of clears that up a bit.
That's why having a buddy is important. Jamie, you've been sitting in the background here. Any thoughts or comments from you?
Not really. I'm only vaguely familiar with the use of bariatric chambers. I know University of Maryland at Shock Trauma has one. And that was mentioned during my first EMT classes about resources in the region. But not having dealt with it. But I do think it's an important thing to reassert that this is something that is necessary, you know, in a lot of different regions, not just near water, because of the fact that people do travel and end up with the illness after a trip, where they're now, you know, in Kansas or somewhere well away from water. So it's important to keep that in mind. And for our providers out there, on the street, to keep that in the back of their head. Good history taking makes a big difference with a lot of different illnesses, and this is one of them.
Yeah, great points, Jamie. And I think Paul's story illustrates that very, very nicely. Paul, since you're a safety guy, what are there certain dangers or concerns around the use of a chamber?
Well, yeah, there's always an inherent danger because oxygen under pressure is a drug. Remember, we talked about that. Well, I don't know if we talked to you about that, but Chris and I are familiar with that from the technical diving side, because we were always told, because we used get oxygen for decompression time, they always tell us that oxygen is a drug under pressure, so we had to keep that in mind. So basically, your most prevalent thing you have is probably 80% of the time, if you have an issue with hyperbarics, has to do with pressure, because you're under, like the doctor was saying earlier, you're under 2 to 3 atmospheres of pressure. So that's usually like a barrel trauma. So it'll be like your ears, or the ears, probably 80% of it. Sometimes you have a stomach upset, or they start burping, which is from their lungs. But that's probably the greatest amount. The more you use oxygen, the other thing too is there is a lifetime limit. And I believe our lifetime limit was 150 treatments. I've never had anybody even had that, but at that point, that matures cataracts and can cause issues.
Wow, that's a lot of treatments. Go ahead.
Well, there is a lot. There's some, because you got to remember, you know, I mentioned earlier in the podcast about there's off-label and there's on-label. We have two separate schools of thought here. The off-label side, because the physician's allowed to use anything in his medical repertoire to achieve the aim. And some physicians use hyperbarics because it has 153 different uses off-label. On-label, it only has 15.
Mm.
So that's what they use it for. I mean, I have colleagues that use hyperbarics for hair growth, weight loss, vision. I'm trying to think of all of them.
Yeah, movie star sleep in them. Anti-aging.
Michael Jackson used his, and his technologist, I believe she was paid $165,000, and she only worked 100 days.
Yeah, good Lord. Not a bad deal. Kevin was surprised because he hadn't heard of that limit. So he was kind of, I guess it's because of the other uses that, frankly, aren't really necessary, but that can create problems by doing it too much.
So go ahead.
Huh? No, go ahead, Paul.
Right. Well, I was saying the 150, that's very rarely will you find somebody that goes to 150 in the clinical setting because of the insurance. The insurance company gets a little crazy with people in the chamber, because depending on your billing, people are being billed, $6,000 to $8,000 a treatment. And you're going out to 150, you got to have some proof to go that far.
Wow. Joe, a couple other things on the danger list I saw were lung collapse, which is a basic barotrauma, and potentially seizures as a result of too much oxygen or an oxygen toxicity. You want to throw in on that?
Well, you covered it nicely. Obviously, barotrauma to the lung, to the ear, to any hollow viscous, so, ear, sinus, GI tract, et cetera, is definitely part of that. Oxygen toxicity, we were touching on there a minute ago. You can see that in all the examples that were given earlier. Neurologically, you can get some of that, although it's a little bit unclear from the neurological standpoint. Is that really related to things like changes in vascular permeability and the body's attempt to auto-regulate itself to control oxygen, CO2, and all that sort of stuff? And might those vascular changes be reducing blood flow to the point where, you get an ischemic area that's more likely to result in a seizure, et cetera? So that, I think that physiology is a little bit less clear-cut than some of the other stuff we've been talking about.
Well, Kevin made a point. He's going crazy in the sidebar here. We should collect all that information. But he was talking about a couple kids that needed to get their eardrums pierced because they couldn't equalize. How often do we see something like that?
Well, okay, that's one of the advantages of a monoplace over a multiplace. In a monoplace chamber, we can adjust the depth, the compression rate, to where we can minimize that to where it's almost not existent. I think in 20 years, I've probably had maybe 5 patients need to have their ear tubes put in. But on the multi-place side, once the thing goes down, it's at a set rate because they're at a set time. They've got a bunch of people on different dive profiles. So you have to go. So if you have ear problems, you're going to go. Your ear may perforate, may not. You might get lucky. And then what happens is they schedule you to have your ear tubes put in. In fact, there's one place, I think it's in Utah, in order to go to the chamber, that's the first thing they schedule you for. You have to be scheduled to have tubes put in.
Aha. Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, Paul, just a quick question about, when you have a patient in a chamber, if there were to be some sort of a medical emergency, how long does it take the technician to get access to them from outside once, an emergency is identified? I assume you just can't crack it open immediately. You've got to dial it down and let it decompress slowly, right?
Well, it's not decompressed slowly. We're decompressing at a faster rate. The monoplace chambers are decompressed from 3 atmospheres, depending on how it was set at the annual, anywhere from, I think the goal is 70 to 90 seconds. And it normally takes 10 to 12 minutes to compress them, and it takes about a minute, minute and a half to get them out. But that time is used pretty well, because here in Las Vegas, we're gifted because our EMS system, we have a firehouse or ambulance within 5 minutes anywhere in the valley. So from the time they have a problem to the office calls for EMS, they're there right about the time I open the chamber door. In fact, one day they were standing there looking at me, waiting for me to open the chamber door. So I think we were gifted here when that actually happens, because we have so many fire stations in the valley.
That's not a bad thing. You know, I was looking down this list, and a couple things, are kind of obvious, like wound care, diabetic treatment, radiation injury, burn therapy, because they're wounds where the higher level of oxygen can clearly make things heal faster. But one of the things on the list, Joe, is brain injury and bleeds. How does it help that scenario?
Well, the same basic physiology is going on here. You're trying to get higher levels of oxygen into tissues that are ischemic or have low levels of oxygen. So, in conditions like diabetes, burns, et cetera, where there's not enough oxygen for the tissue to heal, or the low levels of oxygen promote anaerobic organisms to grow, so chronic infections, et cetera. So for, brain injury and stroke, et cetera, those kind of things that where there's a mismatch in parts of the brain with the level of oxygen that the tissue is requiring and the level of oxygen that's being delivered there, hyperbarics can help push additional oxygen into those oxygen-starved areas. And what you hope is that oxygen is taken up by the cells and helps keep them working as they're supposed to be, or helping them to heal.
Well, one more question for you, Joe. I was considering the disaster-related uses for this, and I found a couple things that are kind of interesting. One is crush injury and compartment syndrome, which you obviously know a lot about. You've taught us a lot about that. But the other one is PTSD. I guess they're experimenting with that now through the VA. What do you think about those two things?
Well, I'm certainly familiar with the first two. I have very little experience or knowledge related to the treatment of PTSD or other psychological illnesses with hyperbaric therapy. And honestly, I would just be speculating to say much about it. I just don't have any insight into that area at all. I'm not at all familiar with that.
Paul, have you heard much about that?
Yes. That's an interesting insight as far as those of us that work within hyperbarics. I'm trying to think what year it was. I think 2018, the VA did a study on TBI, traumatic brain injury, and PTSD using hyperbarics. And they decided that it didn't work. But everybody that looked at the study from the outside realized that they were using way too much pressure. For traumatic brain injury, PTSD doesn't require high pressure oxygen. requires what we call low pressure oxygen, which is that other fuel I mentioned earlier in the podcast of mild HPO. That's going from 1.3 to 1.5 pressure instead of 2 or 3 atmospheres. You're going to 1.3 or 1.5 atmospheres pressure to achieve the aims. And probably the most advanced proponent of that field of mild HPO is a Dr. Harsh in New Orleans, Louisiana. And he has his own clinic, and that's all he treats is traumatic brain injuries and PTSD.
Yeah, I'd sure like to learn more about that, because PTSD is something that we have a great interest in, especially in the disaster world. So maybe we can get a little bit more on that. Well, we got to wind down here. Becky, any other final thoughts or questions?
No, but holy cow, I've learned a lot. It's a very unfamiliar topic and got a lot to research.
There you go. So if you ever go diving, because you go on vacation a lot, or at least you used to, don't get in a plane.
Good to know.
Kevin, you've had all kinds of thoughts you've been throwing in the sidebar, so thanks for that. And you're gonna give Jamie the references to a couple articles you wrote on this topic, right?
Yeah, I wrote an article years ago. I got to see if I can dig that up. But it was to answer the question, why can't I just take an injured diver to any chamber? And I explained all the reasons why a chamber may not be able to take somebody on an emergency. They didn't have gas. They didn't have staff. There's a whole lot of reasons. And a lot of times, like Paul mentioned before, they specialize in wound care, and they don't have the equipment and the staff to treat a diving injury.
Well, there you go. That's good information. Go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry. There's one other thing, James, that you mentioned that I was going to point out. You've had a negative outcome here for just that same reason, because that's exactly what the diver thought. He thought he could go to any chamber, which is 11 in the valley. He thought he could go to any chamber and be treated, and that wasn't the case. So meanwhile, while he's sitting in ER, his illness is getting worse and worse, and he wasn't able to get into a chamber. They shipped him from Las Vegas to Long Beach, to Dr. Strauss.
Wow.
To be treated, because nobody called Dan, and he went to the wrong facility. If he had called Dan, they'd have told him to come to me, but he didn't call Dan, and the ER didn't call Dan. So they had him sitting in the ER for 16 hours, then they put him on an ambulance for a 6-hour ride to Long Beach, and then he had to wait for the chamber to open, and then they treated him. And he's still not mentally right. He has a caregiver that's with him 24/7, because he does things like takes all his clothes off and starts trying to eat himself. So,
yeah, that's kind of a problem. Good grief. Well, it's obvious why they didn't fly him, which is unfortunate in those cases, but it would make the situation worse. Final thoughts, Joe?
Well, fascinating topic. I don't know as much about it as I would like to, and certainly some of these sort of off-label indications for this are really fascinating. I knew absolutely nothing about the psychological side of all this.
Yeah, that's something I want to dig a little more into, because I think that would be a good podcast in and of itself to see what's actually going on and the kind of results they have. So there we go. Kevin, you have a final thought?
Yeah, so just as a reminder to everybody, like everything else, a hyperbaric treatment is a treatment, and it requires a physician to order that treatment. So another reason why you can't just show up to a chamber and ask for treatment, you have to be evaluated to make sure you're able to go into the chamber, because there are some cases where you're not stable enough, or you need to be stabilized first in an ER and then be brought to a chamber. So your best bet is to always call Divers Alert Network. They have a toll-free number, it's manned 24/7. Find out from it, talk to them. They can tell you where to go. They can even call a hospital or an ER in the area, get them up to speed. So everybody who needs to know is aware of the situation and what the treatment should be. That can save you a lot of time, a lot of heartache, and then potentially ongoing problems.
Well, and Paul's illustrations showed why what happens when you don't do that. So there you go, especially when you're a dive master, yeah? Well, Paul, this has been... You have a final thought, Paul?
I hadn't thought of any disaster uses for it, but being on the podcast, now I'll be more on the lookout for disaster uses.
Oh, that'd be awesome, because I'd love to do this again with you, because we only kind of touched the proverbial tip of the iceberg. But, they're not that they can downsize a Harper Barrett chamber, but you're seeing more and more smaller versions of medical equipment in the field. So who knows? I can see a significant burn trauma situation where that would be really helpful. Anyway, more to follow on this. Jamie, I'm going to throw it over to you.
Well, it's interesting as we talk about this and Joe, one of the things that we always talk about with Paragon Medical Education Group is how you guys bring in people with specific knowledge and expertise on whatever subject it is you're teaching. This is an example of this episode of why that's important. We have people like Paul and Kevin on here who are very knowledgeable. Joe, when you guys do training, that's one of the things you excel at, isn't it? To bring in people that have this very specific knowledge and expertise to share with the students that are taking the class.
Well, absolutely. I would certainly not even consider the idea of incorporating any sort of hyperbaric medicine into one of our courses without a couple of these experts that we had on the podcast tonight with me. To teach that component, and that's part of what we do no matter what we're teaching, is we bring in the most experienced, best qualified folks to teach their area of expertise.
If folks want to find out a little bit more about what kind of things you have coming up or what kind of specific customized options you can put together for them, where can they get a hold of you?
Well, we always like to talk to folks because every one of our classes are custom tailored to the needs of our clients. So if folks want to talk to us, please look us up at Paragon Medical Education Group on the web or Paragon Medical Group on our Facebook page. Or you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Excellent. Paul, is there any place in particular that people have specific questions about hyperbaric medicine, the chambers and things that you have experience with that they could reach out to you?
I would say they could call me or email. My email is pwatscht@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely include a link to get a hold of you. And of course, they can always probably get a hold of you through Sam as well on our Facebook group. She can connect people with you. Thanks for coming on the show, Paul. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Paul, we need to, I'll just throw that in. We need to get you, I haven't told you about the Facebook group, but it's 800 something strong now. And that's a place where people like to jump in and ask questions of our guests. And I think this would be a topic that lends itself to lots of questions. So I'll tell you about that later and maybe you can jump in and join us.
Definitely. Kevin, where can folks find you and the Wilderness Safety Institute?
You can find me at wildsafety.com. And as always, I'm always lurking in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And I have all my social media links, or most of my social media links, on the website. And all my contact info is there as well.
Thanks. And thanks for coming on tonight. It's always great to have you on the show anytime.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Becky, where can folks track you down when it's not just summer out there?
Twitter, WX_BCKS, and the Disaster Podcast Facebook page. Kind of half hoping for more interesting weather and half not, because when it's not, it's... I don't know. You don't want interesting weather on top of a pandemic. Let's just say that.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say that Becky, it's always good to have like a slow weather week, even though it's great having you on the show. when we have too much weather going on, there's usually a lot of bad things happening.
Yep.
So,
well, we like
anyway, great having you here. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, fortunately, not where Kevin is in Texas, because it's hotter than Hades down there. Not so bad here in Colorado, but you can find me under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in the usual social media places, in our Facebook group, or on the disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so please look me up and friend or follow me there. And, of course, in our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, where we are just continuing to grow and heading on towards 1,000 members in the group. I'm pushing hard for that. So if you know anybody in the organization who that where you work or associate with in disaster or emergency response, send them over our way. Let's get this group up to 1,000 members. There's an incredibly strong and active organization over there. And I'd love to see the group continue to grow by leaps and bounds the way it has lately. Sam, why don't you kind of wrap up here? Because this has been a very interesting topic. I'm so glad you were able to pull Paul in here and get him on the show.
Me too. Well, we can thank Chris Pressman for getting me back in touch with him. It's good to hear from him after all these years. And it's fun because you never know where your students end up, but it's not a huge surprise that, you know, his diving has led him into hyperbaric medicine. So I guess what we can say about this is hyperbaric medicine is not our everyday medicine.